Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Ruth Graham, who wrote a fascinating article on Slate.com. It's entitled, I Did Not Die, I Did Not Go to Heaven. It's about the author or co-author of a book called The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven. Several years after the publication of the book, Alex Malarkey, who with his father Kevin wrote this book, purportedly, he denounced it. He said, as in the title of the article, that he didn't die and he didn't go to heaven. This is really a fascinating look into a particular movement within the contemporary Christian community. A little bit about Ruth Graham. She is a staff writer now at Slate. She reports on religion and culture. She has also been a contributing writer at the Boston Globe's Ideas section and theatlantic.com, as well as the New York Times Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Poetry Foundation's website, Marie Claire, Al Jazeera, The Daily, and others. She lives in New Hampshire, and we welcome back to Common Threads, Ruth Graham. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. If we can, just in case somebody might be listening right now who was not with us last week, let's do a quick thumbnail sketch again of the book, The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven.
Sure. The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven is a memoir. The subtitle or on the cover, it says a true story. And it's about, it starts with a car accident that Kevin and Alex Malarkey, it's a father and son, had back in 2004. Afterwards, the accounts conflict now, but the book tells a story about Alex visiting heaven as a six-year-old boy, or starting when he was six, visiting heaven and having very detailed encounters with God there, being able to describe heaven in great detail, and coming back, healing or partially healing, and, you know, coming back to tell that story. And then if we jump ahead, in 2015, Alex, by then a teenager, recanted the story and said that it wasn't true, that his father had sort of produced this book dishonestly, and that, you know, he's disavowing it. And that's where it stands now.
And one of the things we talked about last week is the convolution of this story and how one might adjudicate the reality, because you have people who are saying things that might be contradicted by something else that they said at another time. And for instance, the mother, what's the mother's name again?
Beth.
Yeah, Beth. Okay. So Beth indicates now that she was kind of manipulated in the beginning when she was taking part in this, when she was blogging about the experiences. But when you read what she wrote back then, it doesn't seem like that. Of course, Alex, the boy who at the time claimed he did die and go to heaven, he says that he contributed nothing to the book, that it was all his father's imagining of all this. But then you also have this brother Aaron that you mentioned in the story, who says he was there. He heard Alex talk to his father saying this happened and that happened, and he still believes all of this 100%. Am I correct?
Yes, Aaron. So Aaron is Alex's younger brother, and he did say, you know, that he was often in the room when Alex and his father were working on the book together, and that there's, according to Aaron, there's sort of no way that Alex couldn't have known that, you know, that Kevin was putting this book together, that they were very much collaborating on it. You know, Aaron lives with his dad. The younger children chose to live with Kevin after Kevin and Beth split. And so, you know, he's close with his father, although loves his mother very much too. They're not estranged by any means. But that is his account. Now, again, Aaron, this would have been when Aaron was, you know, 8, 9 years old. And, you know, those are some very complicated relationships. It's complicated to talk about memory at that kind of age. But yes, that is his story, and he was very firm about it.
Hmm. But as it stands right now, Alex firmly denounces the book. His mother denounces the book. The father, Kevin, you mentioned last week you had an interview with him, and he solidly stands behind it.
Yes.
Not just that it's true, but that he did not write Alex's portions.
Or, yes, right, that he and Alex sort of collaborated on those two, but that very much like that Alex is sort of the true author of his own sections, yes, and that the stories came from Alex.
Right, right. Physically,
right.
Kevin would have had to have written them.
Yes, exactly.
Them. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I got it. Tell us a little bit about the interview that you had with Kevin, because you mentioned in the article that he first of all didn't want to speak on the record, and mm-hmm. then he changed his mind. So my first question is, when you have somebody like this, as a journalist, you have somebody who says, I will speak to you, but not on the record. What good does that do for you?
Well, it depends, you know, sort of,
I guess if you're a White House leaker, I can understand.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there are times where it absolutely makes sense to just get people's impressions on background, especially if they're not a key player and just have information but want to kind of stay out of it. So it's very much a case-by-case kind of thing. I didn't think that Kevin would speak to me at all. By the time I approached him, I had already interviewed Beth and Alex, and I kind of thought I knew how the story was shaping up. And I just assumed, you know, at one point, Kevin was so off the radar that the Washington Post reported that he was dead in some early reporting on this. They had to, you know, issue a correction. Well, no, he's not dead. He's just so off the radar that he's like unfindable. So I really did not have an expectation that he would speak to me. But of course, you know, since obviously he is a key player, of course I, you know, tracked him down, or, you know, did my best to track him down and contact him. And then it was, I think on a Saturday morning, he emailed and said, like, okay, if you want to talk, I'll talk. So I raced back home. I was at the library with my daughter. I raced back home and told my husband, like, okay, like, Kevin Mularkey wants, you know, is willing to talk, so I have to call him. He said at first, you know, he wasn't sure, and he just kind of wanted to talk to me about, you know, what kind of story is this? Like, what are you thinking about it? And I was willing to do that. But really, within the first few minutes, then he said, no, you know, you can print this. You can print it. You can just print it all. I think he kind of just got going. And frankly, I think after years of having the only other, you know, the other side of the story was the only one on the record until then, I think that it was kind of a relief to him to be able to tell his side of the story publicly. And once he got going, he really got going. He has a lot of, he had been holding back his story for a long time, I would say. So he spoke with me very frankly about how he saw things. So, yeah, it was quite an experience as a journalist to get that note from someone you don't expect to hear from and then to get a very long, frank interview with them.
Sure.
So, and I have to give him credit for doing it. I mean, it's a real act of trust to speak with a journalist, so for anyone who ever talks with me, I'm grateful, but especially when it's such a sensitive and complicated story like this.
You mentioned last week that the family is still religious, mm-hmm. but they've gone in different directions.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Sure. This is something that it was a theme I wasn't able to spend a lot of space in, you know, just because of space considerations in the story, and it's kind of the thornier theological stuff that you know, it's kind of only for the super fans who are interested in this kind of thing. But it's fascinating to me. Beth and Alex have really moved over to the Reformed tradition. So all this sort of visiting heaven and visits from angels and all of that was happening when the whole family was involved with a charismatic church. And very much in that tradition, you know, I'm sure you know about it, but sort of more of a focus on the end times, on ongoing miracles, on spiritual warfare. So their pastor at the time, you know, told me a story about kind of coming to the house one time and like physically walking a circle around the house to protect it from demonic influence. And so that's, you know, a particular tradition within Christianity. Since then, Beth and Alex have started attending a Reformed church and are much more plugged into Reformed sources. And that is a tradition that generally argues, I'm going to paint in kind of broad strokes here, but that, you know, out and out miracles don't really happen in the present day. Much more skeptical in particular of kind of new revelations. So the idea that God would speak to you in a dream and that that is literally, you know, a new word from God is something that Reformed believers would really push back against. And so they came to see their participation in this book that does offer, you know, a new vision of heaven, new words from God, as really theologically problematic. So I just found that. And they have some allies with John MacArthur's group and some really prominent Reformed theologians. Some of their allies have really kind of, I shouldn't say latched on to Beth and Alex, but they're kind of active in those circles now and are getting a lot of encouragement from people who are really fighting against the charismatic ideas of kind of ongoing revelation and ongoing miracles. So it's a major, you know, this is a relationship divide. It's a, you know, kind of psychological divide, and it's also really a theological divide. And of course, you know, which came first or which motivated which is very hard to say, but it's really interesting to hear Beth talk about her theological troubles with her participation, her earlier participation. And she even says, like, my beliefs then were not as developed as they are now, you know, so she does see it in that light too and kind of rejects those earlier beliefs.
And obviously Kevin and his son Aaron, Alex's brother, they're still in that same camp, right? Because they believe.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't want to say too much about Aaron's specific beliefs, but, you know, clearly Aaron still, you know, kind of believes in the book, I would guess that, and since he's still so close with his father. And Kevin is very much still in that tradition. So he currently, or at least as of last year when I spoke to him, he wakes up every morning really early in the morning and has a prayer journal where he's kind of praying and then just like waiting for a word from God and kind of writing down what he hears from the Holy Spirit in that moment. That's not wildly unusual. I mean, in Christian belief, I don't want to paint any of the people in this story as, you know, wackos or anything like that. I mean, all of this, these are just different traditions within Christianity. But Kevin is still, yeah, very much in that charismatic tradition of kind of actively listening for specific words from the Holy Spirit.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGBU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is journalist Ruth Graham, and we're talking about her article, which can be found on Slate.com, I Did Not Die, I Did Not Go to Heaven, which is a repudiation of a book written several years ago entitled The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven by Alex and Kevin Malarkey. So you are correct. There, in Christianity, there's a broad spectrum of how these things can be looked at. Certainly, I believe a lot of Christians that are not connected with anything Pentecostal will still say that they can be inspired by the Holy Spirit, right? I mean, that's
where
we get the word inspire from, spirit. But for the most part, you would say accounts of visiting heaven would go against the theology of many Christian denominations.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say that. And, you know, just even on the face of it, if you look at this cluster of books about visits to heaven that all came out within about this 10-year period, I mean, many of them contradict each other in the details. I mean, they're so detailed that they almost have to. You know, you're practically getting like floor plans to heaven in some of these books, and they do contradict each other. They also contradict the Bible at times, and so, you know, there's kind of a lot for everyone to be wary of. But yeah, I would say that.
I want to mention too that in your article on Slate, there is a picture of Alex in the hospital, such a radiant child. I can totally understand why people would believe him.
Yeah.
You know, if they saw that picture, I mean, talk about innocence, the absence of any guile, just amazing.
Yeah, Alex is very, I didn't meet him in person. We just spoke on the phone. But he's very charismatic, different other meaning of charismatic.
Sure.
He was his high school valedictorian. He was really popular in high school. I mean, he's just someone who, you know, is brilliant and attracts people to him. And so, yes, you can absolutely kind of see how he became the center of this movement for a while.
And you know, one thing that strikes me—I've thought about this a bit, and I'm sure you have too—that this kind of supernatural phenomenon it seems to be encouraged by two different groups that are absolute polar opposites. One would be the Pentecostal Christian movements, and the second would be the New Age movements. Right. Although their whole notion of they wouldn't be describing heaven, if you will, but they're the ones who describe, say, often near-death experiences. But I also want to make a disclaimer that many people who have absolutely no theological background or belief system have reported near-death experiences. But it seems to be those people who really take it to another level, become superstars in the New Age, New Thought movement. Have you done any investigation of that?
Oh, Fred, I'm working on a story that is almost exactly about that. But I don't want to say too much. I won't tell you the details yet. Maybe I can come back and talk about it in a few months.
Okay.
But yes, that is absolutely true. And I'm still kind of thinking through how to articulate that overlap. But yes, it's really fascinating, and there just seems to be, I don't know, an openness to the mysterious in both of those groups, and maybe a distrust of institutions and, you know, formal education, and you know, sort of a distrust of some of the same clusters of things, and an openness to other things that those groups share. That's really, really fascinating. So yeah, that's a great connection.
And also. Well, certainly not. I don't think in the Pentecostal movement you don't have channeling in the Pentecostal movement, right? People don't all of a sudden say I'm channeling Jesus or I'm channeling Mary or something like that.
Well, I don't think they'd use that word, but when you think about speaking in tongues, or you know, and kind of being really overtaken by the Holy Spirit, being slain in the Spirit, they wouldn't use the same language for it, but there's very much an openness to kind of being a conduit, I guess, for the Holy Spirit.
Okay. What I notice in the New Age movement are people who, and they will use the word channel, of course. They practically invented it. They channel Jesus, they channel Mary. Mary is huge in being channeled. But of course, to a Christian, the way we would normally define a creedal Christian, the Jesuses and the Marys that come out of these channely experiences would be practically unrecognizable. That has been my experience just reading about them. I'm not invested in them at all, but just in reading about them and reading about the people who have become best-selling authors in that genre. Yeah, they're not looking to attract
you know, your Methodists and your Episcopalians,
right,
and your Baptists and your Reformed and Catholics, they're looking to attract people who would identify to some degree in what is called New Thought or New Age.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, it reminds me, too, of there's this book, Jesus Calling, which is, boy, it's at least 10 or 15 years old now, and it's one of the biggest Christian, evangelical Christian bestsellers of, you know, probably of this century. It's just consistently, it's still a bestseller after all these years, and there's all these kind of sub-products and hugely popular. And it's written in the voice of Jesus. It's kind of meant to be like an encouraging text. And there are a lot of kind of more theologically conservative Christians who are very wary of it and have a lot of issues of it because it sort of purports to be a new word from Jesus. So, you know, you see it pop up in different spaces.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I would call it a pretty mainstream evangelical, you know, Jesus Calling is a mainstream evangelical bestseller, even though it, you know, kind of rubs some people the wrong way.
Really? Interesting. Mm-hmm. And then there's, are you familiar with Course in Miracles?
Yes, right. Another great example. I haven't read that, but yes.
No, nor have I. Snippets here and there. But mm-hmm. but yeah, that is amazingly huge, and you still have churches all over the country
mm-hmm.
who have Course in Miracles classes, and mm-hmm. it's a thing. It's a thing. In the last few minutes we have, Ruth, just tell us a little bit about your background, how you... I look at your body of work, or at least a portion of it, and mm-hmm. yes, you do write about religion a lot. How did you get attracted to this beat?
Well, I was raised evangelical. I grew up outside Chicago and graduated from an evangelical college. I graduated from Wheaton. And I guess I never had a big break from evangelicalism, you know, a big sort of, I don't have a dramatic story of leaving it, although I don't consider myself an evangelical anymore, but remain very tied to that community and also just interested in it. So when I started out as a reporter, I was living in New York, and that was kind of, you know, the one kind of interesting specialty that I had to offer, I think, at that point. So I had a natural curiosity, but also, frankly, it was kind of like, okay, here's where I have some ins and some insight. And so my career just kind of went from there. I was a newspaper editor for a while and some other things. But when I started, you know, really being a reporter about almost 10 years ago now, that's what I started writing about. And it's certainly not the only thing I write about. I mean, I do other religion stories and also just other stories. But I've been writing for Slate for, many years now. And they've been a great home for me with these kind of, you know, juicy, interesting stories about Christianity. They've really nurtured my work there, so I'm grateful.
And you focus mostly on Christianity?
I do, yeah, I do. So, yeah, not exclusively, but that's definitely kind of the bulk of my beat. Mm-hmm.
So when you entered into the fray, when you joined the dark side and became a reporter, did you see that there was a gaping hole of quality information in mainstream newspapers
Yes.
about religion in general?
Yeah, absolutely. When I started out, I really thought, I shouldn't say no one's doing this well, but it felt like evangelicals were mainly a source of just kind of fascination, like they were aliens and a lot of mockery and not a lot of really insightful, knowledgeable reporting. I think that has changed hugely. I mean, I think about Sarah Pulliam Bailey at the Washington Post and Emma Green at the Atlantic. And I mean, there's a lot of, I think, great reporting. Elizabeth Diaz at the New York Times. There's great reporters now on this beat, many of them. So that has changed for the better. But yes, when I started out, I really thought there's not enough of this happening. So it's really been heartening to see that change over the last decade or so.
Yeah, I must say that over the years I'd read articles in really respected newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post. And I would see things in there, that, not just about Christianity, but of course, being the majority religion of the country, that's usually what, what you'd read about. And I'm thinking to myself, really? Really? They should have called me. I would have been able to get a bit of information. Oh my gosh. Well, I am glad to see that the tide is changing because, of course, I think one of the reasons that evangelicals have become distrustful of major media is because they when they read about themselves, they go, wait a minute, I'm not Ned Flanders.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, listen, Ruth, we're down to the wire for this edition, but I want to thank you so much for joining us this week and last week as well. And yeah, I am interested in talking about that article you're working on now. So maybe in a few months, we'll have you back.
That sounds great. Thank you so much. This was a really fun conversation.
You're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today has been Ruth Graham, a journalist for Slate.com, and we've been talking about her article, which you can find on Slate, entitled I Did Not Die, I Did Not Go to Heaven, which is about the book The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven. Please join us again next week here on WGVU's Common Threads.